Hi, this is Pod Save the UK. I'm Coco Khan.
And I'm Nish Kumar. Coco, Nigel Farage wants us to have more babies. How do you feel about that?
I feel like I've been tricked into being right-wing. That's not really fair. You know, I have my right-wing moments. I watch Homeland religiously. And, you know, I drive a petrol car. I'm at my limit. I don't want to be bamboozled into it. Thanks, Nige.
I will say, if Nigel Farage wants people to have more children, he needs to get himself out of the public eye, because there is very little that softens an erection more than Nigel Farage's face, voice and personality. Aside from that, we will be returning to Farage's comments on the family later, but we'll be bursting the bubble on rumours afoot in Westminster. The government suddenly becomes something of a leaky ship, but does it matter? We'll be joined by Politico's Bethany Dawson.
And later, 5 years on from the 2020 Black Lives Matter movement, what progress has the UK made on racial justice? We're joined by journalist and author Amna Modin.
The pressure has been on for the government, and it appears that finally, it's starting to pay off. Last week, we saw Keir Starmer open the door to a U-turn on the controversial cuts to winter fuel payments after months of mounting anger from voters and MPs. And it appears that he might also be mulling a rethink on the reforms to the benefit system.
So look, it might not be the change we were promised when they took office, but it's a change I'll take. The question is, though, why now? There's something afoot in number 10. So this week, we're diving into the Westminster bubble to figure it out.
A few things happened in the last week. A memo penned by the Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, addressed to Chancellor Rachel Reeves, was leaked. It laid out what we would consider to be a fundamentally more progressive proposal for taxation to plug the budgetary black holes and provide more cash for government spending. Cue outrage and claims of Rayner mounting a challenge for the leadership.
But that's not it. Possibly even more interesting for those watching the bubble, Bloomberg reports growing tensions between Starmer and his chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney, over the two-child benefit cap. So to make sense of what this scuffle means for the future of the government, we're joined now by Bethany Dawson, diary reporter for Politico's London Playbook. Welcome to Pod Save the UK, Bethany.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Bethany, let's just jump in here. What's going on here? How is the government suddenly just turned into a colander of information? What's happened?
Well, the government are saying kind of they're making these changes because the economy has shifted. That is a really quick amount of time for the economy to do a big shift.
Yes.
I think one of the things we need to look to is a lot of pressure from backbench MPs. We sometimes can be quite good at ignoring the influence of these people, but they have an incredible amount of backbench MPs, many of them really unhappy. There was a PLP meeting last week, so all backbench MPs got together and Keir Starmer addressed them, which he doesn't do very often when speaking to MPs and watching them pour out of this room. None of them were kind of grinning. A lot of them said it was really uncomfortable. It was really tense in there. The Prime Minister came to do, understandably, a don't worry, guys, everything's great. And all the MPs kind of seemed to go, you know, are you sure? Is it actually good?
When we say leaks, it's kind of a misnomer, isn't it? This isn't, Angela Rayner didn't accidentally text a plan to the wrong number. This isn't like your mum struggling to use WhatsApp and texting the person that she's talking about instead of texting the person she was trying to talk to them about, right? This is a deliberate political tactic.
Yeah, and before I got into political journalism, that's what I thought a leak was, and I am so disappointed that it isn't. I don't think Angela Rayner like left a kind of note to Rachel Reeves on a park bench and someone found it. You know, someone within her team or Reeves's team have leaked something. They made a deliberate choice to go to the press and share this. And that kind of definitely raises eyebrows around how relationships are going at the top of government.
We understand the Labour Party has always been a broad church and that perhaps Reeves and Rayner come from two separate denominations of said church. Is it perhaps more significant that there seems to be tension between Keir Starmer and his chief advisor, Morgan McSweeney? Now, again, we haven't just found that out because they were having an argument in a Nando's across the road from Parliament. I mean, it felt to me like that's a deliberate tactic by Starmer's team.
The memo makes it look like Morgan McSweeney is the sort of roadblock to a lot of what Labour supporters want to see. And as you say, that is deliberate. Like, it wasn't on a park bench. They weren't screaming at each other in a Nando's. Someone has made the strategic decision to frame Morgan McSweeney as difficult in reaching what Labour voters want to see. This puts pressure on Morgan McSweeney. It's not just kind of putting a memo in the brains of journalists to try and figure out if he's being difficult. It puts pressure on McSweeney to let these more left-wing changes happen.
So this characterisation of Starmer being like held back by Morgan McSweeney, is it true? Is it true? I mean, part of me hearing this as a, you know, someone outside of the party thinks, oh, it's a bit lame of Starmer to be suggesting that he's being held back by this man he could fire. Is it all a performance or is it actually true?
The thing we have to remember is Keir Starmer is the prime minister.
Right.
He is the man with the most political power. The people in number 10 are incredibly powerful, but there is only one person that can stand up as the prime minister in the House and make a statement. There is a team, but he isn't a little puppet. He does have an incredible amount of political power and there is a balance there.
There's two ways of looking at this current situation, isn't there, Bethany? Because on the one hand, we've got the mutiny in the Parliamentary Labour Party, pressure coming from the backbenchers and high profile Labour MPs who are more on the progressive wing of the party that's forcing Starmer to capitulate to this. Now, that's one version of events. The other version of events is that Labour is running scared of reform. And on a domestic agenda, at least, Farage seems to be trying to out-Labour Labour. So on Tuesday this week, he had a huge press conference where he announced that ending the two-child benefit cap would become one of reform's signature policies. He's spoken out against the winter fuel payment. How much of this is pressure from the PLP and how much of this is pressure from Farage on the Labour Party?
I think Farage has been really clever here. So last week, Wednesday, Keir Starmer said that they were going to consider changing that winter fuel payment and the eligibility criteria. I don't think many people in the electorate will have heard that, right? It was a like 30-second statement at the beginning of PMQs.
Yeah.
And what people will hear, though, is a big Farage statement where all the press is going to one of his 7,000 press conferences that he seems to do.
How does he have time to be an MP? Being an MP is quite a hard job.
Well, I think that the answer is he doesn't. And he doesn't be an MP. That's his thing.
Yeah, last week he was in France, I think, and then this week making massive statements. I don't know when he had time to go to Clacton, but he does these press conferences and the media go to it and we all get very excited about it and it splashes the front pages and people see those messages from Farage. And I think what he did was look at the trajectory the Labour Party are going in and figure he could get just a tiny bit ahead of the messaging to make it look as though he's the one putting pressure on. The likelihood is those decisions have already been made within the Labour Party, whether it's balancing the books so they can make these cuts, whether it's figuring out who's getting what amount of money in the spending review. Whilst those conversations are ongoing, the themes behind it and the trajectory is probably fairly set. And Farage will know that, but he will know that he can look like the mastermind behind Labour if he runs home from his French holiday and makes a quick statement. The vibes were really interesting at the press conference because it was all done within the guise of supporting British families and helping people to have children, which is quite an interesting form of politics that seems kind of imported from the States. America is very like, you know, pro the family unit and pro tax breaks for parents and married couples. But the policies that he's announced within that fairly right-wing set of ideals is fairly left-wing. And I wonder if that is going to be difficult for him, because whilst none of us are expecting his next statement to be like a universal basic income, it does seem almost a bit too left wing for his supporters to follow. It feels like the path is winding too much and he risks becoming this kind of politician that really just grabs what is hip at the certain time, which is the exact politics he's been railing against.
Right.
Also, you know, it is tricky because there is quite a significant historical precedent for somebody combining socialist economics with nationalist rhetoric. In terms of the sort of Tory party, they've now sort of slipped to fourth place in some polls behind Reform and the Liberal Democrats. Farage was barely focusing on Kemi Badenoch, talking more about Robert Jenrick. I mean, I feel like we ask this every week, or certainly we ask this whenever we get a Westminster reporter in. She's done, right? Surely.
You just don't really see her that much, yeah. Which is the thing that is really weird. I quite respect this. She's kind of known for hating mornings. So she doesn't do morning rounds, really.
She should lead with that. That's actually relatable politics.
Got my vote. Like, I, you know, hugely respect it. Someone was talking to me the other day about how during her leadership campaign to switch off, she'd play The Sims. And I was like, she's got her comm strategy all wrong. Lead with not wanting to do mornings and The Sims and first place in the polls. But she doesn't do the sort of things you would expect from a major Westminster party leader. Who does, though, is Robert Jenrick. Robert Jenrick does the morning rounds, and then he goes to the sort of grassroots campaign events. And he doesn't say, vote for me for leader, but he definitely does say, am I not just fantastic? And you can't move for seeing him. Mm. He just is everywhere. He's very, very good at being present. And I think for a party that feel directionless, they have very few policies. And I don't think any MPs know what their line is. They don't feel supported. Having a present politician who at least knows the events that are going on and who's where and who's caring about what is actually quite attractive. And of course, we're seeing so many reports about the Conservative scheming to try and get Kemi out before November, which is when theoretically she is safe until. You can't have a leadership election more than once a year. But there are loopholes, and it's according to, again, leaked memos, it seems as though they're trying to figure out a way to just oust her, which means another Conservative leadership election.
Oh, goodness
me. Jesus Christ. Before we let you go, Bethany, I just want to ask you one very quick question. If we're talking about things like the two-child benefit limit and we're talking about things like the winter fuel payment, if the Labour Party does U-turn on this, is there a danger for the Labour Party that it looks like it's politically weak?
I think people have quite short memories. So by the time we get to a general election, I doubt there will be a huge swathe of people that wouldn't vote for them based on these policies. But it does look like they're bowing to pressure. Rather than having had a few years to fix the economy and then standing up and saying, here's our growth statistics, here's everything that's changed, we're now in a more comfortable position to do X, there's just not really been enough time for those fiscal changes. So it does just look like they're bowing to pressure. The way you spin that is saying, we listen to the electorate and we listen to our MPs. But I think a lot of people will take that as spin. And a lot of people will think they are easily changeable, especially with this rising threat of reform.
Bethany Dawson, thank you so much for joining us on Pod Save the UK.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, if you want to hear more about the bubble and everything that's going on, then you have to see Bethany's work. Check her out on Politico's Daily London Playbook newsletter.
And we have a very exciting announcement. Pod Save the UK is heading to Sheffield this July for the Crossed Wires Festival.
We're playing a live show at the Crucible Theatre on Sunday the 6th of July alongside special guest Gary Stevenson of Gary's Economics to unpick the shitstorm of British politics. We'll be dreaming up radical solutions alongside Gary and you.
Tickets are on sale this Friday from crossedwires.live. We can't wait to see you there. I was actually in Sheffield last week doing a gig at a great venue called the Lead Mill, which is sadly soon to be no more. But a local brewery brewed a beer with my face on it. So
no.
that is now my bare minimum for Sheffield. The floor is yours, breweries of Sheffield. That is my minimum expectation of doing a live show there. So challenge extended.
I am just curious about this. So if I want to order one, do I ask for a pint of Nish?
I don't think it's now widely available. I think it was a one night only offer.
You can't down a pint of Nish.
No, you can't. But we will expecting. Okay. We will be expecting a pint of Nish or a Coco Khan cup of hot cocoa.
Yeah.
After the break, we'll be speaking to journalist Amna Modine about the 2020 Black Lives Matter protests and what progress the UK has made on racial justice.
PodSave the UK is brought to you by Shopify.
Shopify could be a catalyst for turning your business dream into a reality. Whatever your dream is, whether it's being an astronaut or the president, you get older and your dreams change a little bit and they focus less on running the world and more about how you can take your skills and ideas and turn them into something real. Instead of dreaming of going to space or owning your own castle, maybe start dreaming of owning your own business. If that's the case, you're going to need a website, a payment system, a logo, and a way to advertise to new customers. It can all be overwhelming and confusing, but thankfully, that's where today's sponsor, Shopify, comes in.
Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the US, from household names like Mattel and Gymshark to brands just getting started.
What if you can't design a website? Shopify's got you from the get-go with beautiful, ready-to-go templates to match your brand style.
What if I need a hand? Well, get help with everyday tasks like enhancing product images, writing product descriptions, or generating discount codes with Shopify's AI tools created for commerce.
What if people haven't heard about my brand? Shopify helps you find your customers with easy-to-run email and social media campaigns.
And what if I get stuck? Well, Shopify is always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support.
Turn those dreams into and give them the best shot at success with Shopify.
Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
Go to shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk. Sunday, 25th of May, marked 5 years since George Floyd, an unarmed black man, was killed by a white police officer in Minneapolis. His last words, "I can't breathe," echoed those of Eric Garner and a number of black Americans who have died at the hands of police. Floyd's murder sparked a fresh wave of protests for racial justice that spread across the world.
In the UK, we had protests in 260 towns and cities. The statue of the slave trader Edward Colston was toppled into a river in Bristol. After that, we had statements from the Bank of England apologising for their historical involvement in slavery, as well as pledges from the Church of England to pay reparations.
The Black Lives Matter protests were the largest anti-racist rallies in the UK since the abolition of slavery. However, today we're seeing swings in the wrong direction. Anti-migrant riots gripped the UK last summer. A surging Reform UK has vowed to target equality, diversity and inclusion policies. And we have a Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, accused of echoing the racist rhetoric of Enoch Powell.
Half a decade on, how far has the UK come in tackling racial injustice? Joining us now is Amna Maidin, the author of Scattered, which traces her journey from being a child refugee in Somalia to becoming a British citizen. And now she's The Guardian's community affairs correspondent. Amna, welcome to Pod Save the UK.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is an interesting role reversal for us because we have previously only spoken when you were interviewing me.
Yes.
And now the shoe is on the other foot.
That was actually one of my earlier stories for The Guardian. So I remember being really scared because I was going to interview a celebrity.
God.
Yeah. And then you found out it was me and you were like, oh, that's absolutely fine. I've got no reason to be fazed by the F list.
You've reported on Black Lives Matter since the death of George Floyd. Just honestly, what was it like covering it? At the time, did you feel that you knew that you were living through a moment of history?
Yes, it really did feel historic at the time. So if I get you guys to cast your mind back to 2020, I mean, these past 5 years feels like 15. Well, we're still at the height of lockdown. And it started to become really clear the disproportional impact that COVID were having on BAME communities. There was this really striking Guardian front page where we put a picture of the first four doctors to die from COVID, and they were all Black or Asian. And I think that really began to show who are our key workers, who we're putting in danger to protect us. Many young BAME people across the country were living in these tiny flats. They didn't have access to any gardens. So of course, like, the death of George Floyd was a spark because it was once again another video, which was horrific, of a Black person being killed by the police. But actually, I felt at the time what was happening with COVID was probably the bigger spark here. And it's just all exploded at the end of May. People broke lockdown laws and rules to be able to go out to protest. They felt really that strongly about it. At the time, we were a bit unsure of how to cover it. Like, you know, should we go out? Like, are we allowed to? But I felt really strongly that we really needed to be there. I felt like this was going to be a moment as powerful as 1981 in the UK, which was when we had the Brixton riots. But not only did the entire protest remain entirely peaceful, but it was so multiracial in a way that I don't think we've really seen before in the UK. So I definitely felt like I was part of history when I was in the middle of that protest. Also felt very old. I should add, I was like 28 and everyone there was like, oh my God, have you revised for this A-level exam? I was like, oh my God.
Well, as the oldest person on this call, that makes me feel absolutely desiccated.
I'm 33 now, Nish, so yeah, that's fine.
Why do you think the domino effect conversation happened? Because it started with a call for kind of racial justice. Mm-hmm. But then I think back on it as such an extraordinary period mm-hmm. of time, because my whole life in this country, there's no discussion about colonialism. There's mm-hmm. no discussion about slavery. I remember doing history A-level in England, and the only time we talked about colonialism was because you get to choose one subject on your mm-hmm. A-levels, or you did in the kind of early 2000s. And I chose to do the partition of India because for all of us, it lives in the memories of our families. You know, mm-hmm. I have Indian resistance fighters in my family, mm-hmm. one of whom was sort of shot in the back by British troops. You know, so the legacy of it lives in our families. Why do you think it had that kind of domino effect where it actually was the kind of holistic, all-encompassing conversation about racism and its history that a lot of us had been trying to have previously before that?
I'm still startled by the fact that these quite old, very British and English institutions like the Bank of England were releasing statements about slavery. We had commitments to reparations. These are things that we've never seen before and felt like everything was suddenly moving so quickly and I couldn't pinpoint exactly as to why it was happening, just that it was. I think, though, one of the reasons is the significant amount of confidence that a lot of young people brought to that conversation. So I interviewed 50 young Black Britons between the ages of 16 to 21, all the way from, you know, like Southampton to the Shetland Islands. Astonished Black people were up there. I think that was the first thing I said to that 17-year-old, what are you doing up there? I asked him, why now? Like, what has driven you? And I think social media has played a really big role, but then also you do have really powerful books like Renee's book, Why I'm Not Talking to White People About Race, that have just crossed into the lexicon and it's just became part of everyday language. This was also the same generation that were part of school strikes for the climate. So they had been politicized on other issues and they were connecting the dots in a way that I wasn't doing until my mid-20s, I think. So I think that kind of really came to the fore and people felt we have to respond to this moment. But there'd been a lot of work that had happened previously. So there was an entire campaign to get rid of the Cecil Rhodes statue, probably 5 years before BLM in 2020. And that had just been completely ignored, even though most of the students were in favour of it, the faculty were in favour of it, the local council were in favour of it. And same with the statue of Edward Colston in Bristol. And the authorities just were not listening. So people did just take direct action as a result of just being ignored for decades upon decades.
I mean, you paint quite a vivid picture of a kind of snowball effect, you know, gathers momentum to create this utter huge magnanimous force. So then how do you square the circle with the fact that a lot of this is being undone? You know, you talked about the Bank of England. They have rolled back some of their DEI commitments. Mm-hmm. They claimed it was because it didn't work with the growth agenda or whatever it might be. And we see it left, right and centre from council scrapping their DEI agenda. And obviously Nigel Farage's party Reform UK, they're making a big push on making this a formal thing to abolish DEI. Is this reversal of DEI something that progressives should care about?
I actually just wrote an analysis piece asking, you know, particularly those of us who are quite critical of identity politics or are critical of the way DEI has been utilised by these big corporations, should we be celebrating its downfall? And every expert that I've spoken to, an intellectual, has said no quite strongly, because actually what DEI represents in this country is inclusion, even though it's come about as a result of Black and Asian people in this country fighting for their rights. It means inclusion for disabled workers. It means inclusion for women. I mean, I've just recently come back from maternity leave. It was ensuring that I have like flexible working arrangements for my child. It means inclusion if you're, you know, LGBTQ. Like it's an all-encompassing word that's just about having a level playing field in the workplace so we all have access to the economy. The huge backlash against it, and they go for the acceptable group that people hate, Muslims, Black people, Asian people, is part of a much bigger ideological battle to roll back our workers' rights. I really believe this quite strongly. There are attempts by certain parties and other figures within more mainstream parties to go for, I think, the Equality Act. We're seeing that. Suella Braverman's been quite strong on that. Jacob Rees-Mogg has been calling for the abolishment of the Equality Act. But we're also seeing, you know, Robert Jenrick talk about these anti-white policies just because, you know,
my
a job
eyes
advert.
Rolled so far back into my head. Oh my God, it hurt.
And we don't even have like these targets in the UK in the way that the US does. We don't say you've got to hire an Asian person, you've got to hire Black. It's never been that in the UK. It's been much slower. It's always been a voluntary thing. People have been slowly won over to this. So we're actually in a really strange situation where certain politicians are saying, no, we're going to roll back on this. And businesses are saying, well, no, it's been working for us and we don't want anything to do with that because it's making us lots of money. We're much more accessible to like different markets. So just like the obvious thing is I've got curly hair, Boots and other, you know, big high street brands having Black hair products makes sense for them.
Yeah.
It's because they just like expand their customer base. So we are in a really strange position where, you know, leaders are meant to be leading. Our politicians are meant to be leading, but they're really not on this issue.
The moral leadership of Boots. One of the major demands from the protesters in 2020 was police reform. But Baroness Casey's 2023 review of the Met following the death of Sarah Everard concluded that it is institutionally racist, misogynistic and homophobic. Black-led organisations are calling on the government to complete a follow-up. Has there been any progress made on police reform, especially when it comes to, you know, dealing with women or dealing with Black and minority ethnic people?
So I was actually just listening to an interview on Radio 4 today where a police officer was saying some of Casey's recommendations are being slowly implemented. One being that if you have a background check and you fail it, you shouldn't be given a job. Seems obvious.
I didn't realise that the inverse was true. That you fail your background check and you can be a copper.
Yes,
wow.
Because you can't just have a forward-facing role, I think was what it was previously. So I was going to answer that question as no, but I just heard that this morning. So it seems to be some efforts, but the police haven't responded yet properly to the Casey review. Often when there's a racial reckoning in the UK, whether there's an uprising, protest, riots, or there's a really horrific tragedy like the killing of Stephen Lawrence, and there's loads of public anger, the state responds with a commission or a review or a report. Often what's in those reviews or the reports are quite powerful points about racial discrimination. And from 1981, there was a bit of a hesitation to use the word institutional or systemic. But by the time we get to the McPherson report in 1997, it's quite clear that the UK has an issue of institutional racism. But what we wanted to see was, okay, how many recommendations were there? We found about 600 in the 12 reports that we decided to analyse. We know how to have fun at The Guardian, just us in this spreadsheet. And we wanted to see and analyse how many of those reports have actually been implemented. And we were quite generous in what we were considering fully implemented. And even with that, only a third of those 600 recommendations since 1981 are fully implemented recommendations. And unsurprisingly, it's ones that are like, we're going to have diversity training, you know, we're going to improve the guidance, we're going to make sure people are aware of that the UK is a really diverse country, but much more systemic changes that many of these reviews were calling for, like certain accountability, that, you know, a police officer should be fired if they've been found guilty of racism. That's not the case. That is shocking to me that we're just in what Ted Cantor, one of the commissioners, described as a doom loop. And then something else that really stood out to me was that how the impact of austerity, obviously we rightly reported on and discussed just how much austerity really impacted families who live in poverty, but it also did so much to roll back the few progress that we were making on racial equality. So many of, for example, Cantor's recommendation 2001. So Ted Cantor was the commissioner who was asked to come on after the 2001 riots to look into questions of segregation, inequality, and on opportunities. And many of his recommendations were undone through austerity and just stuff that didn't have anything to do with money, like, you know, making sure that schools have a public duty to promote integration in different areas. Those were just removed through some of Gove's reforms for schools.
We're talking the morning of Wednesday, the 28th of May. And this morning, Amna, you've written a piece in The Guardian about the terrible incident that happened over the weekend in Liverpool. A car was driven into a crowd of people who were celebrating Liverpool Football Club winning the Premier League. The police described the suspect publicly as a 53-year-old white British man. Now, that feels quite unprecedented in terms of the speed of disclosing the ethnicity. And that is obviously very connected to what you've already talked about, which is the race riots that happened last summer after the horrible murder of girls in Southport. Then misinformation spreads about the ethnicity or the identity of the attacker, and that instigates race riots. And now the police are releasing this person's ethnicity to get ahead of online misinformation to prevent race riots. So all of this coming against a backdrop of a Labour Prime Minister using language that echoes Enoch Powell's. The combination of all of these things has left me with a real depressed sense about where we are with race relations in the UK at the moment. What would you say, just for hypothetical sake, what would you say to a 39-year-old British Asian man with a as yet undiagnosed case of IBS and a fondness for the music of Bob Dylan and Outkast, if he were, for example, again, and I'm plucking this completely out of thin air, profoundly depressed about the state of race relations?
Two things. Just first on Liverpool, it was a really staggering decision by Merseyside Police, one that a lot of people could understand. So it's also worth pointing out that was the police force that was also responding to Southport at the time. So this is how they feel like they were learning from that lesson, and they wanted to put a stop to the racist and Islamophobic posts that were already out there within minutes. And there was apparently, I haven't seen this, but someone took a picture of someone else saying it's this man. So I think they really wanted to get ahead of it, but it really shows we are living in really terrifying times where a website like that can exist. That's just a cesspool for misinformation, disinformation.
We're talking
hate.
About Twitter specifically in this instance.
Yes,
but
yes,
social
exactly.
media in general.
Yes, exactly. And I think we just can't leave it to the police to decide, because you're going to be in a really weird situation where they've made it quite clear this isn't going to happen every time. So when are you going to name the race of the suspect? And could it not just backfire if the next time you choose not to and he's not white, people begin to start saying things like two-tier policing, which we know isn't reflected in the data of disparities in the criminal justice system. So they're in a real weird pickle, I think. And that second question of hope, how do you continue to feel hope? I'm a generally quite a hopeful person. I'm a very happy person. And I don't think you get to, like, you know, survive a war and like come from a refugee camp and not think, damn, I'm a bit lucky and things can get better. I don't want to be someone who doesn't feel like it can get better. And it's really depressing that from the top, we're not seeing what we were hoping to see from a left party, right? Like, we're not seeing the language, we're not seeing the leadership that we want to see on these questions. But change doesn't ever come from there. You know, again, just going back to these race reports, that was never going to be actually meeting the demands of the movement. Like, one person that I spoke to said that, yes, we want the saris and we want the, you know, the Somali fish stews. We want to celebrate Black History Month, but actually we want something also done about the racist bordering system that you have. We want something done about Black and Asian kids doing so well at school. Why aren't they getting into the best universities? Why aren't they getting the best jobs? So the more systemic question gets ignored time and time again. So we probably all need to stop looking upwards for that change to come. It's going to really come from us. And on that question, I think people are mobilizing, you know, that's really easy to see. And I think maybe it's on us to make sure that we're covering them better and highlighting their work. Like, I've really been thinking a lot about, what does it mean to be a news reporter in this moment? And is it just highlighting the pain and the suffering? Or are we also going to give people their autonomy and reflect their autonomy.
So we do want to talk about your book. So in your book, you explore your family's journey from Somalia to the UK.
Yeah,
to
there I am.
Oh, there he is.
I'm holding the book up.
He's holding the book.
In the window.
How do you think things have changed for people seeking asylum today?
We're living in a completely different world now. It's really, really frightening. It wasn't illegal to come to this country through an irregular route. So these aren't routes that are officially sanctioned through UNHCR. It wasn't illegal to seek asylum. That was the post-Second World War world that we live in. That has now changed. It's quite shocking, I think, when we see how refugees and asylum seekers are written about. With the horrendous Southport attacks and the riots that followed, it's really important to remember that the rumor that was going around was that he was a Muslim asylum seeker that came on a boat. That is really scary and really striking. And I think we're also in this quite frightening juncture where, yeah, our prime minister, that's a Labour prime minister, has been criticised for echoing the language of the far right. But one thing that I always say, when you have these really strong speeches on immigration, how are you going to get people to tell the difference between who is here as a legal immigrant and who is not? How are you going to tell the difference between who has a right to be, who's British and who's not? Often when you are being out attacked in the street, those aren't distinctions that they're interested in looking at. Hey, let me see your British passport before I punch you in the face. So it is quite scary, the language that we're seeing. And just speaking to some of the anti-racist activists and trade unions I spoke to for the piece, they did say, like, actually, the left really needs to wake up to this moment and that it's a harbinger of much more far-right politics to come. So we really need to be on our guard.
Where do you think people who want to, you know, who want to be part of this anti-racist fight, where do you think they can go politically? You know, is the Labour Party still a home for people who care about anti-racism?
So we just did some reporting on this to ask how BAME Labour voters kind of feel. And for a lot of people, that speech from Starmer was just the last point. Like, they couldn't take it anymore and they have cancelled their membership. But I'll be honest, this has really begun much earlier than this moment. I think his initial response to Gaza has been a breaking point for a lot of BAME communities. And then, of course, BAME residents across the country are also impacted by winter fuel cuts, also impacted by these proposed cuts to PIP. People are really, really angry. They don't know where to go. On that question of where to go, I wish I knew. I really don't. I'm very interested to see how progressive parties respond to this. I'm interested to see what happens from the Green leadership. I'm interested to see if there's going to be, you know, a new left party. It seems to be always being teased. But what I'm always really interested in is, again, just as a community affairs correspondent, won't be a surprise, just community activism. We're always covering what are people doing on that very local level. And there's something really quite powerful about being part of a community when people are, when you're being told you're an island of strangers, actually going out and saying, no, we're not. I think that's a powerful political statement to make. Now that I'm both a mum and an auntie, I'm happy to say, put down your phone and go out and talk to people.
Amna Modine, thank you so much for joining us on Pod Save the UK.
Amna's book, Scattered, it's an extraordinary memoir and a story behind the headlines and statistics about refugees and what it actually means to be a person fleeing persecution. It's an extraordinary book. It's called Scattered and it's out now.
After the break, we'll be returning to Nigel Farage's latest attack vector on the government, the family. The News Meeting podcast from The Observer is your insight into how journalists decide on the top story.
On each episode, three guests pitch a story that they think should lead the news before the editor gets the final say.
It's out every Monday and Friday, where you can hear what some of the top journalists, thinkers, authors and news enthusiasts think should lead the news and why.
There'll be live shows hosted in the Observer newsroom once a month with special guests.
In fact, I'm one of them. I'll be appearing at the live show at South by Southwest, so do check it out.
Search for The News Meeting wherever you get your podcasts and follow the feed so you never miss an episode.
That's The News Meeting podcast from The Observer.
Now, Coco, we spoke earlier about Nigel Farage's press conference on Tuesday, but one thing we thought we'd save for later is this.
So we want to go much, much further to encourage people to have children, to make it easier for them to have children.
Yeesh. So Nigel Farage wants more women to have more babies and for it to be easier financially to bring up kids, which is why he went on to say that he wants to lift the two-child benefit cap and make the tax burden lower for married couples. He, of course, stressed that the policy is, and I quote, aimed at British families. It's not aimed at those who come into the country and suddenly decide to have a lot of children here. So don't worry, everybody. He's still a Don't worry, everyone. In case you were worried, I'm sure that word has been bleeped and I'm happy for it to do so. Everyone knows what I said, though. I think we could all agree we know what the word was.
Oh, my God. You know, I read about the story, but hearing that then was the first time I heard his actual voice. And it genuinely made me convulse with disgust. It's so opportunistic. Nigel Farage doesn't care about women. Nigel Farage doesn't care about, like, our ability to live to our fullest potential because of a society that allows us to fulfill our childcare and child desires as well as a professional and you know, creative and other aspects of our personality. He doesn't care about any of that. He's just trying to essentially say, look at foreigners, they have loads of kids. We're going to, you know, help our lot. We're going to help the indigenous British. And it's just it's a dog whistle way of saying that, you know, they're overrunning us, basically.
This is a sort of far right conspiratorial talking point. They always say things like Western birth rates, right? And, you know, and Farage said we want British families. We all know what we're talking about. You know, the dogs are being whistled, you know.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
A Baha Men song up in here. The dogs have been whistled. They've very much been let out. We know what they're talking about. We are in favour on this podcast of improved policies for working mothers, given that 50% of the hosts are currently working mothers. I mean, how do you feel, Coco? As somebody who's just given birth to a child, is living as a working mother, surely, I mean, I would have thought you would be very in favour of more sensible and positive and supportive policies for working mothers, right?
Oh, yeah, of course, absolutely. And, like, you know, if somehow the change ends up coming because of the pressure that Nigel Farage applies, okay, it makes me uncomfortable, but whatever, you know, I'll take it. This is a overdue conversation that needs to be had nationally, and change needs to happen so quickly. It's outrageous how hard it is to just have a child. I would say, though, that a really good way of improving the social conditions for childcare and raising a child is, of course, you know, childcare costs, housing costs, maternity leave, flexible working, but also paternity leave. My other half, he works from home, and it has been such a transformative thing to have another full-time, well, I won't say full-time in case his employers are listening, but, you know, have another person who is available in the house. I seriously doubt Nigel Farage would be up there being like, I really want to bring Britain in line with France and make sure that men have guaranteed half a year off. I just don't think that's going to happen. In addition to his dog whistle racism thing, there's probably a dog whistle sexism thing, isn't it? Of like, women fulfill your duty of having lots of babies. I do also just want to make one more point on this, which is that how is he going to decide which are the foreigners coming here to have children and who are the Brits that are worthy? I mean, I'm, you know, my mum was an immigrant, but I was born here. My partner is white British. We have a mixed family. How does that work? How is that going to work with the administration? It's so frustrating how average people are just so much more egalitarian than the politicians that go up there and paint these big visions for Britain. Do you know what I mean? I mean, as someone in a mixed family, the only real conflict we have is not about our immigration status. It's just my mum constantly asking my husband all the time, are you cold? That's the main thing. I mean, he does wear shorts in December. It is weird, isn't it? But anyway, it just really rankles me hearing this. And now he's going to lead the conversation. And now the conversation we need to have about childcare is all going to be about, well, yeah, but who should get the support? Who shouldn't? And that's what it's going to be. He set the tone. He set the notes that we're going to talk about.
I imagine if you were disquieted by that, you're going to be even more disquieted by what he went on to talk about. Because Farage actually waded in on abortion.
Wow.
I am pro-choice, but I think it's ludicrous, utterly ludicrous, that we can allow abortion up to 24 weeks And yet if a child is born prematurely at 22 weeks, your local hospital will move heaven and earth and probably succeed in that child surviving and going on and living a normal life.
Look, it's important to note that Nigel Farage has previously worked with the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is an influential group on the US Christian right and part of a global network of evangelical groups behind the repeal of Roe versus Wade in the United States. And it's one that's working to make inroads across the Atlantic. I really think it's important to caveat his remarks with that. So there is some appropriate context here. You know, this isn't something that he's just decided on the spur of the moment. He has had a connection with this group and it is worth flagging. There is a kind of shared interest there, clearly. Coco, what do you think listening to that? I mean, it's alarming.
It's really alarming. And again, it's so opportunistic. If the rules or the guidance needs to be updated, then of course, that's fine. Everything's moving. It's the science is changing. Of course, let's do that. And let's do that based on the well-being of both children and their mothers, of course. But I want experts doing that. I want doctors doing that. I don't want Nigel Farage doing that. I mean, just off the top of my head, and I am not an expert at all, you know, you get a scan at 20 weeks. Sometimes it's more like 22 weeks with NHS waiting lists. And at that scan, you can find out that your child has a debilitating illness. That means they might pass away in agony after a few months of their life. Some women may choose to terminate that pregnancy. Under his rules, no doubt they wouldn't be allowed to do that. And do you know what I mean? He'll pluck an example out of thin air being like, yes, it is true that more babies are at 22 weeks are being saved. Many aren't. But nonetheless, he'll pluck that out of thin air to make this politically expedient point, which is that essentially, you know, I'm Nigel Farage. I'm the agitator. I've basically seen what's been successful in America. And I don't care who hurts and suffers because of that. I'm going to use those tactics here in the UK and I'm going to be supported by a far right group. It just makes me so angry. And for even just starting a sentence like that, I'm pro-choice. No, you're not, mate. No, you're not. I'm going to move on.
I mean, I will say that we've certainly talked about this on the show a few times, this idea that the right to abortion is something that there is a kind of global network that is trying to sort of pursue and has successfully done so and overturned in the American legal system, which is leading to individual American states now being free to outlaw abortion. And it does also give kind of important context to why a Labour MP like Stella Creasy has been fighting to codify in law the right to an abortion and fully decriminalise it. She was writing in The Guardian this week under the headline, "The right to abortion is under threat in Britain, secure it now or risk losing it." And it is important when you hear things like that coming out of Farage's mouth to understand that someone like Stella Creasy is not engaging in needless scaremongering and alarmism. This is a real threat that's coming and it is really something that we need to be concerned by and engage with.
And of course, look, it must be very frustrating for progressives to feel like they're having to answer questions posed by the right that have already been answered. The question of abortion, i.e. should we have it? Is it a good thing to have in society that this is a legal thing we can do here? Yes, that's been answered a long time ago. And they, you know, you have these right-wing people dredging up these almost like old settled debates because they've seen that it's successful in other territories. And now progressives have to waste their time answering this rather than laying the foundations for an even more progressive world. And I understand that that is really, really frustrating. And actually, if we're having conversations around reproductive rights, you know, Britain needs to improve in many respects. Maternity care needs to, that's the conversation we'd want to be having as progressives. But now we're here having to talk to Nigel Farage. And I get that frustration. However, I really hope that Labour and all the progressive parties do that piece of work because it is crucial. Don't ignore him. You know what I mean? Like, we need to prove our progressiveness and show how our policies, our economic policies, our individual policies, our approach to healthcare can make the world a better place, make Britain a better place. Otherwise, him and his scaremongering, I worry about it. I really do worry about it.
And support for reform is clearly rising and it is something that the government needs to be concerning itself with. At the moment, it seems to be chasing its tail by just being reactive to what Nigel Farage is doing and saying on a week-to-week basis. But I think what's crucial is that the Labour government articulates a clear vision for the country and one that chimes with the majority of its voters, animating its base, you know, and producing a policy packet that changes the country for the better. The one thing everybody agrees with is Britain is not in a good condition right now. That is the one thing everybody agrees with. And it's just really important, I think, that Labour actually articulates a positive vision for that change that they keep saying they're promising is coming. But look, it's always worth noting in serious times that there is still some funny stuff going on, and it's all coming out of the absolute clown show that is the Conservative Party. We know that Kemi Badenoch is in trouble as Conservative leader, but that hasn't stopped her from demanding a new car. So there's a story that's been circulating this week that Kemi Badenoch has been demanding a new car that would be more befitting a future prime minister. And I mean, how far in the future are we talking here, Kemi? Because under the current circumstances, that thing, that you being prime minister is about a million years off.
Also, it's quite a nice car that she has. It's a Land Rover. I mean, that's a fancy car.
First of all, driving a Land Rover in London, you're an absolute embarrassment. The streets just aren't big enough. What are you doing? But it is a car that's provided as the leader of opposition to her by the goddamn taxpayer. So it begs the question, what car is Kemi Badenoch after? Is she looking for a red Tesla like Donald Trump? Does she want a Rolls Royce? I mean, I don't know.
She wants to get like a yellow Maserati that she's going to park outside Harrods.
It's a huge, huge claim to be doing this shambolically bad a job that everybody agrees is a bad job that she's doing. Like, there's no one who can point to a single element of what Kemi is doing as being successful. That's across the political spectrum, but it is a huge call in the middle of that to say I should have better wheels.
I would not like to suggest what she would like, but I can imagine that with her fantasies of what she would do, it would be some sort of anti-woke Batmobile that would have powers to, like, I don't know, just stop a vegan in its tracks or something. I don't know what her fantasy is.
Listen, it might be more fitting that she just has a clown car. And also, you know, given the way that the Conservative Party's going, a decently sized clown car might house all its MPs that she's going to end up with.
And that's it. Thanks for listening to Podsave the UK. Don't forget to follow at Podsave the UK on Instagram, TikTok and Twitter, and on Blue Sky at podsavetheuk.crooked.com. And if you want more of us, make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel.
Podsave the UK is a reduced listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to senior producer James Tyndale and producer May Robson.
Our theme music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
The executive producers are Anishka Sharma, Louise Cotton and Katie Long, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
And remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify, or Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.